We normally start every podcast with a bit of a lighter bit where we joke around a little bit. But this week, we wanted to take a serious note and have a moment in which we honor the findings that just recently happened in the Prairie Green landfill as Mercedes Myron's remains were uncovered. Previously to that, Morgan Harris's remains. We know that a very contentious selection campaign was run in Manitoba debating the merits and value of Indigenous women's remains. We want to send our love and our thoughts out to the Myron Harris families, and particularly give credit to all of the activists and family members who fought so long and hard to find their relatives in those that their final resting place. And of course, we send also our thoughts and our love to Rebecca Contois' family and the family of Mashkede Bijike Ikwe. The search continues for Buffalo Woman. And of course, we send all of our great thoughts. A moment like this doesn't ever have to happen again in Manitoba. And that's kind of our message for this week.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Nigan and the Lone Ranger. Please welcome your hosts, Nigan Sinclair and Dan Lett.
Bonjour, Tansé, greetings, bonjour everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast.
So it appears that the thing that I've spent weeks telling people couldn't happen, which is that the conservatives, you know, are still expected to win the election. I mean, hey, what's going on with the liberals is interesting, but the liberals could still.
It is a shift. What do you call it? A seismic shift?
Yeah. It's, I love the word seismic. other than lamentable, I probably use the word seismic more than any other word.
I use the word Armageddon a lot these days.
Armageddon. So for those of you keeping score at home, most national polls have the liberals in a statistical dead heat with the conservatives. A couple of polls actually have the liberals up by more than the margin of error. It's nonsense. It seems like nonsense, but there's something really going on here.
Since early January, January 6th, Justin Trudeau resigns. And I think in any other time, in any other moment in Canadian history, a prime minister resigns and the party just goes in the tank. It just generally whoever takes over is seen as a caretaker. It was often thought of that Chrystia Freeland would be that person to sort of shepherd the Liberals into what their people were calling a keep the lights on campaign or keep the furniture campaign. And then Donald Trump comes in, is sworn
and then
in.
Came Trump.
To completely turn everything into the topsy-turvy upside down. The upside down now looks like the Liberals have come from 26 points down to a statistical tie and in many polls leading, particularly for a friend of the podcast, Eric Grenier, who is the most recognizable, well-known pollster in the country. And he came out recently just saying a lot of very interesting things about the federal election. We're not there yet. We're probably going to have a federal election announcement this week. So any announcements would just be certain speculation. But I don't actually have any precedents for this time to think about a party that's turned around 26 points in the matter of about 2 months.
Yeah, there are unconfirmed reports right now that Poilievre and his senior staff are running around the core of big cities in the country, randomly pinching people, hoping that they will wake up and see, like, pinching.
I thought you were about to break news there.
That's right. Or slapping them across the face, like.
Certainly eating a lot of apples, maybe yelling at people.
What's the matter with you? And the reaction I'm getting from Tory friends and sources is they're blaming us, the media. Which also kind of makes sense then that on the date that we are recording this podcast, that the Conservative campaign has decided to break with tradition and will not carry reporters.
There's no flights for you, Dan. It's not happening.
So for those of you who don't know, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Conservatives or Progressive Conservatives always they fly. They get a plane to fly the leader across the country to campaign.
Usually well painted.
Yeah, and they actually underwrite the costs of those flights by charging exorbitant amounts of money to news organizations to put reporters on the plane so that they can go in lockstep and with the leaders as they make appearances. And you know, it's not like it's like tens of thousands of dollars, you know, to ride the plane. And I, you know, I have ridden the plane in past elections. And it's also like a really great way of getting to know the leader a little bit more. Like they often, you know, again, in tradition, you know, they ride in first class and the reporters are in cargo and, or no, in economy. And, but the leaders come back and, you know, they visit with the reporters and often there are opportunities, you know, to ask questions kind of off the
famous
record.
Sort of insider something or other, yeah. Off the record, but on the record.
Yeah. And so in the 97 election campaign, Jean Chrétien was prime minister and liberal leader. And he came back into the plane and people were asking him sort of off the cuff questions. So I asked him, he used to do this thing in campaign appearances where he would be introduced. You know, it doesn't matter, Ontario, Nova Scotia, Alberta, whatever, he would be at a campaign office and somebody would say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister of Canada, the future Prime Minister of Canada, Jean Chrétien. And then he would come up and he would go, hello, everybody. Thank you. And as we like to say in English, merci beaucoup.
My wife always said to me that growing up with Chrétien as somebody at the peak of politics, it was always hilarious to her that whether he was speaking English or French, he didn't sound like a native speaker of either language.
No. So when he came back into the plane this time, I finally said to him, you know, Prime Minister, seriously, you know, as we like to say in English, merci beaucoup, where did that come from? You know, because it kills, right? Like everybody loves it. And he goes, well, you know, one day I'm doing a speech and I make this mistake. And everyone laughed. And afterwards, Helene, his wife, said, Jean, wherever you go, you should do that line. And true to form, you know, he did it. So, you know, like, you know, I wasn't going to ride on Mr. Poilievre's plane this time around. But, you know, I don't think it's positive development that they've decided that they're going to try and cut serious news organizations and political journalists out of their campaign structure. And yeah, I just think it's a shame. And this is like not a partisan analysis. I don't really have a horse in the game. I just like a good election, you know, but I don't think that bodes well for the Conservatives.
It certainly will result in a much more controlled message. And it's also something that the Conservatives might be out of control of now. And it's the biggest moment, I think, is that you're seeing a Conservative Party, which has been a well-oiled machine, well on task. And we were talking just before we recorded about kind of they're probably the most popular in recent memory successful slogan, successful messaging, being able to brand Justin Trudeau as the problem of everybody's lives. And if we just got rid of him and then boom, they got their wish and now they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to handle. Yeah. And I think that this evidence of not being able to control those informal moments on the plane or in a press conference or on the streets is something that they just don't know how to handle. So they're just eradicating it completely, not including you, and you get no pretzels.
Well, Godspeed Conservative campaign is all I can sort of say. You know, we occasionally reach out here at Negan and the Lone Ranger. I guess we've gone back to the original title.
It's the best title.
Okay, so we reach out to knowledgeable people across the country. Today, I'm super excited that we've got Max Fawcett, the lead political columnist for the National Observer. And if you're not reading Max Fawcett,
brilliant.
You know, he really is brilliant. Actually, you know what? Just read his Twitter feed. You know, and Blue Sky feed if you want a LARF because he's
incredible. His succinctness. I've had an opportunity to get to know Max mostly through electronic means. Famously, probably the best moment of his life as he defeated me for the National Newspaper Award last year. This is probably on his mantle somewhere. Not the award, but just beating me.
Yeah, we didn't want you not to win here at the podcast, but we also recognize what we needed a bigger studio, you know, to fit you and your ego in.
So just to slap me in the face, they brought the guy that beat me onto the podcast.
Yeah.
I noticed you booked a guest this week.
So. I told you when we started this that my job was to keep it real. So that's all I'm doing is just keeping it real. Geez.
Well, luckily, Max is incredible, really humble, nice, but a lot of politicians very nervous when Max comes around, starts writing about him. And I think he's ruffled the feathers, not just of conservatives, but also liberals. You know, Naheed Ninchi and famously Danielle Smith in Alberta, I think, has certainly not the president of the Max Fawcett fan club.
No, but then again, I was once told by a very, very smart and close friend of mine that as journalists, we can measure the success of our efforts on the list of enemies and not the list of friends that we keep by the end of.
Actually, our enemies read us the most.
Yes, that's right. So here we go. A conversation with Max Fawcett of the National Observer. Max, the first question that I ask almost everybody on our podcast, what the hell is going on?
And please say that in 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I was going to say, do we have 3 hours here to talk about it? I think we're in the midst of the most terrifying and remarkable moment, certainly in my lifetime, in political history here in Canada. I have no sense of how this ends. I think it could end very badly for us, but I think it could also end very, very well for us. And that's sort of the tension that we're in right now. Is we're seeing this resurgence in nationalism, in patriotism, in a sense that we can get things done, in you know, sort of a belief in our fellow neighbor. Where all these conversations that didn't seem to be available are suddenly available. And I think that's exciting. It just would be nice if, you know, the Americans didn't invade us. And that's kind of the thing that is animating everything right now. Yeah. So, you know, may you live in interesting times, but maybe not quite this interesting.
It's funny. So I've toyed with the theory. I think a lot of commentators have noted that the anti-Trump, anti-American, pro-Canada sentiment has turned the Quebec political equation on its ear. Has really muted the sovereigntists. I'm wondering in a place like Alberta, where you're probably about as close to ground zero for the clinging, lingering anti-vax, anti-mask, anti-government. Like, have some of us put aside our, you know, Trudeau is a dictator and we're living in a, you know, dictatorship? Have we put that aside, or is it? You know, is it still lurking, ready to come back, you know, at any moment?
I think it is still there among that portion of the population. You know, let's call it 10%, 15%, maybe 20%, that really feels like the vaccine mandates were a form of dictatorship and all that other nonsense. And, you know, they helped get the last premier of this province pushed out of office. So they are not nothing here. It is a considerable force, and it's one that, and maybe we'll get into this later, the one that, you know, our premier here is constantly genuflecting towards in ways that just don't happen, certainly not in Manitoba, certainly not in Quebec, other parts of the country. And so, you know, I know that the Alberta Firsters, the Alberta Separatists, who have been around forever, are rubbing their hands right now at the prospect of, you know, Mark Carney becoming or winning the next election. And I think they think that this is finally their moment to make the move. I don't think that they're going to go anywhere with that for any number of reasons, not least that they have no idea how the treaties with Indigenous nations work here. But they are excited about it in a weird way that isn't present in the rest of the country. I mean, I will say, you know, speaking to the strangeness of our times, I never thought that a guy like Mark Carney would be the one to revive liberal fortunes in Quebec and put the separatist genie back in the bottle. And so I think, you know, for pundits, certainly this is something I'm trying to remind myself of a lot these days. We have to be humble, which is hard. I think a lot of people who come to punditry are not inherently humble people, but you know, the things that we thought we knew 6 weeks ago don't exist anymore. And the things that we thought were impossible 6 weeks ago are now happening. So we all have to, I think, kind of ground ourselves in a level of humility that maybe doesn't come supernaturally.
It's, I mean, politics on its head on every corner, I think, is a good way to think about it's to describe the time. It's like we live in the upside down. That's the way I describe it to people, because here in Manitoba, we have the NDP, which are now the Patriots, and the Conservatives, which are debating race relations amongst themselves. Like there is a weird kind of trend, and I think we see it the most maybe flipping or turning or certainly being interesting on the right side of the spectrum. And I think it's because of this kind of Venn diagram that's been created out of Donald Trump. And you've written lots about this. One of my favorite pieces you wrote in your newsletter recently was how Canada's Conservatives trump themselves. And you kind of go through blow by blow the kind of challenge of the Venn diagram, which is that amongst Conservatives, there is this tension of you've got a U.S. president who's threatening to invade you, but you also have tremendous support amongst those same people for the ideas, policies, the specter of Donald Trump as a whole. You're literally in the epicenter of that, I think, in Alberta. What is this Venn diagram, and how can we sort of describe it? Yeah, like it's a real anomaly. It's never before sort of seen that a U.S. president threatening invasion is actually very popular in a certain segment of the politics, and not fringe. Yeah, we're talking mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones who are willing to really embrace the threats are in a minority. It is a sizable minority within the Conservative Party of Canada, and especially here in Alberta. You know, call it 30%, 20%, whatever it might be, who are openly supportive of us becoming the 51st state. You look at the rest of the country and support levels are, you know, below 10%, approaching zero. So it is the ground zero for that sort of sentiment. It's a tough spot that Poilievre finds himself in. And to be clear, it's one he put himself in. So I'm not sympathizing with the man, but you know, he is now in this difficult spot where a large percentage of his supporters really like Donald Trump, even after the threats, even after everything that we've been put through. They still really like him. They like him on the culture war stuff. They think he has a point on, you know, Canada being a freeloader. And so they're not really willing to go as far in terms of opposing him as people in the other parties are. Some of them aren't willing to go far at all. And so he has to walk this incredibly fine line of saying, well, no, we're not going to be the 51st state and we're proudly Canadian. But, you know, it's kind of Trudeau's fault that Trump is threatening us. And it's really the Liberals who are to blame here. And you look at the polls lately, and I'm sure we'll get into this in a sec, it's not working. That line is not being walked effectively by him, because I think most Canadians look at this and understand it's not our fault. You know, he did this to Greenland. He's doing this to Panama. Like, it has nothing to do with Trudeau. It has everything to do with whatever, you know, squirrels are running around in Donald Trump's brain. And he just can't speak the way he speaks about almost everyone else. You know, Poilievre loves to attack other politicians, the media, you name it. Like, he relishes nothing more than getting his teeth into something.
And eating an apple.
And eating an apple, yes, teeth as well. But he you can see him just nibbling like the most delicate little creature on this Trump issue, because he knows that if he says too much or goes too far, those voters will simply go to the People's Party. And all the work that he's done over the last 2 years of, you know, embracing the anti-vax movement, of kind of walking in a way that makes PPC voters feel safe in his party, is going to be undone. Genuinely don't know how he gets himself out of this. I think this could be the whole ball game, but I think we're going to have to wait and see on that.
By the whole ball game, do you mean his life, his political life? Is that what you're saying? You think that high risk this time?
If he doesn't win this election, that is, they will dispose of him in short order, I think, and go back to the drawing board for another leader who can please the base but not repulse mainstream Canadians, and so far they're 0-2 on that front, I think. Yes. But yeah, I mean, he's bet the farm on basically being a Trump-like character. And that was a really good idea right up until the moment Trump started threatening us and threatening our sovereignty. And now it is the biggest weakness I think I've ever seen a politician have. I don't really see how in a month, over the course of an election, he can convince Canadians he's not the thing he's told them he is over the last 2.5 years.
There was a funny moment, and I think it was last night. I was watching a TV program with a bunch of pundits, and everybody had this shocking moment where they realized, oh, Donald Trump hasn't talked about Canada for like 3 days. And everybody was, oh, like, they were like, what a, that's why we're breathing this fresh air. And then, of course, then this morning, right? And I think that, you know, we spent a whole year and a half talking about foreign election interference. Here we are, Donald Trump now involving himself directly in the Canadian federal election. He announced this morning that he'd rather face a Liberal government than a Conservative government, which is a direct support of Pierre Poilievre, which is trying to posit that he's, that somehow Poilievre's moves have turned him into Captain Canada or whatever. There is a polls, you know, polling that seems to be coming back. And I think you mentioned just a minute ago, Mark Carney becoming kind of the savior of liberalism in the country and the kind of the anomalies that that's created. One of the friends of the podcast, Eric Grenier, was just talking about polling and the polling that he's been doing. And he said something really interesting. He said that if there is a tie going in the Conservatives and the Liberals are tied, that means a Liberal minority. If the Conservatives are to get in any way a minority or a majority, they have to be at least 4 points or above ahead. And the more every point leads them towards a majority, with the soft number being around 6. That's fascinating. That's a, it tells about the Liberals' efficiency of the vote, but also tells you the kind of centralism in where you are in terms of that conservatism, that vote.
I mean, I've been banging this drum for many, many years now, and Conservatives do not like it when I give them advice, but it is well-meaning advice, and the advice is basically, you guys need to stop genuflecting towards Alberta and Saskatchewan so much, because you're good there. You've got it all, you know, with a few exceptions. They run the roost here, and you know, winning ridings by 50% is the same as winning a riding by 5% or 2% or 1%. You know, a win is a win, and they should be, and they should have been, trying to bring forward policies and bring forward leadership that appeals more to people in Manitoba, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, the Merit, like, you name it. And they don't seem capable of distancing themselves, first and foremost, from the oil and gas industry and its interests, and second, from the political culture that Conservatives have built out here. And, you know, I hate it. Well, I don't hate to say it. It is kind of inextricable with a lot of the things that Donald Trump has talked about and a lot of the ideas that Donald Trump has brought forward. And so it will take, I think, a new leader, a new approach, a real sort of comprehensive rethinking of what it means to be a Conservative, to break from this sort of disproportionate influence that Alberta has over the Conservative Party of Canada. I do worry that we may get an election result where, let's say, the Conservatives win by 2% in the popular vote, and they, you know, they have 30 fewer seats, and we'll get this outbreak of people saying it was rigged, it's fake, it's not democratic, and we don't need that right now when we're dealing with Donald Trump. So
that's a,
you know, my sort of,
yeah,
my fervent hope is either it's a Conservative majority or it's a Liberal majority. You know, we need clarity right now on this one. The last thing we need is an opening for the foreign actors, mostly Russian, some American, some from other parts of the world, China, to further destabilize our trust in institutions and our trust in our democratic system.
So I was recently having a text firefight with one of my best sources in the Federal Conservative Party, a guy I've known for so long. You know how they become your friends, right? Like, we, mm-hmm, you know, we hang. And man, you know, he was as mad at me in particular and the media in general than I have ever seen. This is a man who's first and foremost kind of a pragmatist, very practical guy. And, you know, like you, like others, I had been writing about how there was a point at which what they were doing, the hyperbolic allegations against the Liberal Party, like a lot of it just made up. The name calling, the attack dog you know, and the axe to tax stuff, that there was going to be a point where they ran out of runway. And there was, they were going to be asked to tell, to provide a different message. And I think the comment that probably ended the relationship is when I said to him, you know, it's going to feel really horrible on election day when you guys realize that people like me were giving you guys advice on how to save your majority. And you didn't want to pay attention. You didn't want to, like, all this talk about pivoting after, you know, the trade war started. They haven't pivoted at all. And, I'm just wondering, like, do you foresee, and I was going to connect this to one thing that's connected to this question. You saw the statement today, from the party about how they're not going to allow reporters on the leader's plane.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So to me, that signifies that they're not going to pivot. They see the media.
No, it's all TikTok.
Yeah. That's right. They're going to go direct to social media. Do you see a scenario where they can recover from the collapse that they've kind of engineered? I mean, they had help, but they certainly have not served their own cause. Is there a way back for them?
I mean, I think after, you know, we saw successive Angus Reid polls put the Liberals at 16% and then 42%. I think anything is possible. You know, the days of saying that you know, something is not conceivable. I don't think that's a thing we can say anymore. But in terms of the people around Polyev, the team they have, and their sort of instincts, their political instincts, I don't think they have the right people in place to do the things that are required here. You know, he is very clearly a guy who takes pride in having believed the same things he believed since he was 16 years old. You know, Jenny Byrne, his campaign director, you know, she has a very specific and particular way of approaching politics. And these are not people who believe in the idea of moderating or conceding or turning into the wind. You know what I mean? They think they're going to fight their way to a majority. And I just don't think that's what Canadians are looking for right now. This is sort of, you know, one of the most unique moments probably in political history in terms of the speed at which what Canadian voters wanted has changed. I can't imagine, even if Donald Trump came out in a couple of days and said, you know what, tariffs off, I'm good. I'm not going to invade Canada. It doesn't look like that's what he's going to do, but let's say he has a change of heart. I think Canadians have been so traumatized by the last few months that they are looking for something different now than they were before Trump arrived. And you know, it's Paul Wells's, I believe it's his fourth rule of politics. I might not have the right number right, but he says the person auditioning for the job of opposition leader will get the job of opposition leader. And that's what Polyev's doing right now. He is auditioning for the job of opposition leader. He's not acting in a way that is prime ministerial. You know, he, in his remarks today about, you know, Trump, he said Trump endorsed Carney. You know, no, he didn't, but that's a whole other issue. But then, you know, he immediately pivoted to attacking Mark Carney. Like, that is not what people are looking for right now. And I just don't know that he has it in it to give it to them. You know, I think he is who he is.
Yeah,
and that worked really, really well. And I think, you know, to your source's anger, the conservatives I talk to, they're pissed off because they thought they had this thing in the bag. And they feel like it's not fair that they suddenly have to contest an election. They are still in the, you know, in the stages of grief. They are still clearly at anger, right? They're not bargaining yet. They will soon, but they're right now they're mad.
Or if when he does come out, because I think about the march in Ottawa, and I happened to be in Ottawa that day, and I saw the massive flag, and I saw the kind of march to. Felt very, one of the few moments it felt kind of back to the trucker convoy occupation days. And I mean, that kind of energy, that exuberance, that kind of patriotism that is very passionate. And it's undeniably so people that are committed. But it's almost like every time Polyev wants to respond to Trump, it's a second too late or a minute too late. And it's that pause that you talked about, that kind of negotiation of what do I do, which is evident of, I don't think they do know what to do.
Yeah.
And it's almost a rudderless party ever since Trudeau resigned.
Yeah, you can almost see him flinching when he's about to do it. It's like, oh, you know, I hope I don't upset too many of my supporters by saying this. And there's no flinching on the part of Mark Carney, right? Like he knows everyone in the Liberal movement, in the Liberal Party is aligned behind him. He doesn't have to worry about it one bit. And so he can do the things that need doing. Polyev every time is, you know, in his mind, he's calculating, he's weighing, what do I do? How far do I go? And you're right. It is like a striking contrast to the Polyev that we had gotten used to, who was, I mean, annoyingly sort of almost childishly on message, but like he was so consistent with his slogans, his message. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. And people knew what he stood for. Now you're right. Like they're kind of grasping at straws.
I can't tell you a slogan. I can't tell you a moment that he's gained the attention.
They're trying axe the entire carbon tax now, which is maybe a way of saving the warehouse full of T-shirts that link, you know, somewhere near the Calgary airport.
But that right there is a real tell to me, is that they still want to fight the campaign they thought they were going to get to run, right? They still want to fight the axe the tax election, and they haven't processed and come to terms with the fact that's done. Yeah. No one cares, right? And the more time and energy they spend trying to, you know, salvage the value of those T-shirts, the more damage they're going to do to their standing in the actual election we're about to have.
Yeah, I think at some level, politics requires an almost Rain Man-like ability to look at the chaos and see the order. You know, like look at the stir sticks on the floor and see something in it. And the best politicians that I know, that you probably know, are those people who can cut through the noise and they can find, you know, the right angle. In the first couple of weeks of Trump's barrage of insults and threats against Canada, you know, came this story about fentanyl and about how Canada was this major supplier of fentanyl. So I'm imagining now the people in the Tory war room. Wow. Okay. So the U.S. is really concerned about fentanyl. The story ended up being, of course, that we're not a source of fentanyl, that more likely, you know, the fentanyl that's in Canada is coming here from the United States. So while that story was coming out, and the Globe and Mail did some good work and on that story, then the response from the Tory war room was, well, we're going to do minimum sentencing for fentanyl kingpins, which put them directly in the – like it put them – moving in the wrong direction on the issue. It was an uninformed, position because of the actual direction that the drugs are flowing, but also because anybody in law enforcement will tell you, they never get the kingpins. So you can threaten them with, you know, longer sentences, but they don't. They get the dealers and the distributors. They never get the kingpins. I don't know. So that, I mean, that kind of goes back to my, I'm trying to imagine a path back for them. I wonder at some point they're probably going to have to release a campaign document. Have they got anything? Do you get the sense they have any tricks up their sleeve, anything to bring to the national debate right now that could actually stop people long enough to say, oh, well, you know, maybe, you know, that PR guy. I don't know.
I mean, Jenny Byrne always has tricks up her sleeve. I think the question is whether they're going to work in this environment. I still think that they are a machine built to fight a different opponent, and would have done it incredibly effectively. I do not think that they are prepared to fight a Liberal leader who has killed the carbon tax, who is clearly pro-business, who codes as a business person, who codes as a knower of finance, and who is willing to discard anything and everything from the last 8 years, if that's what it takes to win the election. You know, it's sort of similar to what happened with the Democrats and Kamala Harris, where, you know, Harris was unwilling to criticize, what Joe Biden did as president. Mark Carney has no such constraints on him. He will criticize whatever he wants if he feels like it advances his cause. And I just don't think that they are prepared for that. And so they're going to relitigate things, like the government's record, the carbon tax. They're still trying to sort of have that change election, when I think right now what Canadians want is not change, but stability. They want stability. They want judgment. They want someone who can let them sleep through the night. And Polyev's, you know, wiring as a politician is as someone who breaks things, who destroys them. You know, there's a book that's coming out now called The Ripper. Mark Bury won a bunch of awards, great writer. And it's all about how Polyev is a ripper. You know, he rips things apart, and that's just who he is. And that's not what we want.
So we've talked about the conservatives. Let's shift to the liberals. The liberals, by default, their campaign will be defined by Mark Carney's campaign to become leader and the promises that he made and some clever promises. It's nice to see, quite frankly, like we can debate whether or not the carbon tax was a worthy policy or not. I mean, I think it's a shame that the liberals did such a bad job of explaining it to people. And, you know, and Polyev was so effective at convincing people that it was the root of all that was wrong with our lives. But, you know, his quick embrace of the idea that consumer carbon tax had to go was great. Capital gains tax, again, something I wrote and thought was actually a progressive, you know, change to the tax system, gone. Okay. So he's a pragmatist. Do we similarly, can we see the path now for the liberals to actually survive a campaign and the scrutiny of a campaign and maintain the momentum? Can they maintain that momentum through a campaign where there will be debates and daily flares and other things? Is that sustainable?
I think that is the big question now. I think in a more normal time, Carney's weaknesses as a politician would get exposed. You know, you saw that press conference with Rosemary Barton and a few other journalists where he got a little bit hot under the collar about the way they asked him about the conflicts of interest. And he clearly is not a professional politician. He does not have the mileage that anyone in his position should and would have. But I don't think that's a weakness right now. I think in any other election, you know, I think if they had parachuted Mark Carney in there and Kamala Harris had won, he would be made to wear the sins of the party, and he'd be made to wear his lack of skills as a politician. But, you know, I don't think we want a politician right now. I think we've seen what it's like down in the States. They have lots of, you know, Trump is in some ways the ultimate politician. I think what we want is someone who's effective, who's good at their job, who is stable, who knows things, who has, you know, experience. And I think Canadians are going to be more willing to forgive the inevitable slip-ups that Carney makes than they would have been in a more normal environment. Now, how much damage can the Conservatives do to him over the next little while? They're very good at you know, tearing candidates down and damaging them. And I think they will definitely land some blows. But Carney's also, or maybe it's his team, I don't know, but he's also shown a level of political astuteness that I wasn't entirely expecting. You know, the trip to Europe coming first was very smart, very tactical. You know, him inviting Vladimir Zelensky to the G7 was very smart, very tactical. It throws a grenade right in the middle of Polyev and his party because they have some real tensions all over the Ukraine issue, just as obviously the Trump party does. So they have shown themselves to be savvier than I think some people probably thought. And I think sometimes we forget that, you know, Mark Carney, as the governor of the Bank of England, spent years dealing with the British press. British press is incredibly hostile. And I don't say that in a bad way. I just, you know, it is the highest form of that art. And he learned how to handle them. I am not all that convinced that he's going to have a hard time in the course of a Canadian election with the Canadian press gallery, with conservatives, with whatever gets thrown at him, because I think he's had a lot thrown at him in the past.
I think this will be the first federal election or federal leadership or where somebody announced their leadership on a U.S. Comedy program. I mean, that's basically what he did. And I think more people probably watched that than they watched his actual announcement on just a few days later. Let's pivot quickly to Alberta and – mostly because, well, two reasons. One is, you know, it's fascinating to watch Alberta from outside of Alberta, because I think in many ways these tensions happening in Alberta, we're now seeing them elsewhere. We could say the United States, we could say the Parliament in Ottawa, as these kinds of things that often happen in Alberta first rather than elsewhere. And so
test pilots for the craziest of ideas.
Yeah. And we talked just a minute ago about Poilievre, his reaction to Trump. But you also saw a big step back or a step to the side, or I'm not sure, because she seems rather invisible, perhaps, on the issue of Trump, is Danielle Smith. Danielle Smith, of course, famously went down to Mar-a-Lago, was in photographs with Kevin O'Leary and Trump, and then, of course, sort of famously said, I'm just going to go out on my own here, and Canada has no right over energy in Alberta. Doug Ford did something similar on his own, kind of acting on his own, but quickly snapped back into the federal national unity discussion. Danielle Smith has gone mysteriously silent. It could be because of the scandal involving the former head of Alberta Health and the fact that she's being sued right now, and there's quite strong evidence to show corruption and certainly a lot of poor decision-making in that process. But, I mean, what's happening there? Can you give us sort of an on-the-ground understanding of why is Danielle Smith so quiet? And then second is, like, what are we not getting in terms of, is she waiting to make some other announcement or waiting to see what the federal Liberals are going to do? She's made sort of jabs at Carney, but that's about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. She has said that, you know, we need an election right now, as though that's not exactly what the Liberals are going to give the country probably this weekend. So it is a weird posture for her. I mean, she really stuck her neck out on her initial approach to dealing with Trump, which was to take him at his word. You know, oh, he says fentanyl is a big issue. We're gonna throw some costumes on these police officers and pretend we have our own fentanyl force. And, you know, she really kind of bought what he was selling. And maybe that made her look good among her base. It did not make her look good to the rest of the country. I think most people saw that she was being played a little bit. And you know, she went down there. She went to Mar-a-Lago to try to cut a deal for the oil and gas industry. I do wonder how farmers in Alberta, the people who work in any other sector of the economy, felt about their jobs and their livelihoods basically being sacrificed at the altar of oil and gas. But that was the choice she made. And, you know, she tried to brag that she was the reason why the tariffs on oil and gas were lower. I don't think that's actually true, but even if it were, again, you know, you're sacrificing big parts of your economy just to protect this one sector. You know, that she has a view that she can flatter and charm her way to some sort of detente. She seems to think that the play is to increase our relationship with the Americans. You know, she wants to build Keystone XL. She said that there's multiple pipelines that she wants to build. She wants to double Alberta's oil and gas production and send it to the States. That is a very weird response to a country that is threatening your sovereignty. It is a very weird response to a broader sort of national conversation that is saying, we need to get away from these guys. We need to diversify our trade relationships. So it feels like she's going into business a little bit for herself. And look, I've heard the rumor, because all conservative premiers in Alberta have to have their eye on their next job, because none of them have finished their first term or a complete term in office since Ralph Klein. I've heard it said that she has her eye on going into the U.S. media. You know, she's a former radio host. The market is much bigger down there. It is much more profitable. Maybe she feels like her next play after she's premier is you know, being part of the MAGA media universe. I don't know.
That's breaking news out there.
But you know, it is striking the extent to which she and, to a lesser extent, Scott Moe have really kind of broken from the rest of their provincial peers in how to deal with this. And so far, there's been no payoff for Alberta. We'll see, I suppose.
Does Danielle Smith have a best before date that's coming into focus? I mean, you mentioned on the fact that Alberta premiers don't serve multiple terms in office. You know, I've often wondered if Alberta, the political culture of Alberta, has just evolved to the point where someone like Danielle Smith could be premier for as long as Danielle Smith wants to be premier. you know, or at least is the point you made, at least until she decides she no longer wants to do it. Very few politicians get to make that decision, as Justin Trudeau just demonstrated. So does she stay as long as she wants to stay? Is there no Naheed Nenshi, another friend of the podcast?
I was about to bring up Naheed.
Okay. Sorry, man. It's Mr. Nenshi was on our podcast on the day before.
The leadership, yes.
Yeah, the day before he did the leadership. Can anybody, could Nenshi take down Danielle Smith, or has Alberta just gone so far out on the limb that it's, you know, a sane leader is, you know, has no card to play?
I feel like Nenshi should be able to take, you know, should be able to win an election in this province. I'm actually working on a piece right now about this, so I don't want to give too much of it away, but I have not been thrilled with how he has been as leader. It feels like he has conducted himself like he's the mayor of Alberta, and that is not the job that he has, and it is not the role that he should be trying to fill. You know, there are so many things going on in Alberta right now that should be outrageous. You know, our healthcare system is melting down in some respects because the UCP is, you know, redesigning it, and they call it, I think, refocusing is their word, very Orwellian word, but, you know, they're tearing it to the ground. And we're losing doctors, we're losing nurses. It's chaos. And of course, then there's this accusation that, you know, her government asked the CEO of Alberta Health Services to basically like give these inflated contracts to these companies that happen to be friendly with the government. It's, you know, it's a mess, and the NDP can't seem to do much with it. You know, part of that is the media environment is just structurally hostile in Alberta to the NDP. You know, the Herald and the Journal to some extent are really willing to go along with almost anything the UCP does. But, you know, part of it is that Danielle Smith is a very, very talented politician. She is very good communicator. She is very good at walking this tightrope that has tripped up other conservative leaders, where you have to maintain credibility with the rest of the province, but you must never run afoul of your base, right? And Jason Kenney lost the leadership and his premiership because he did some small things on COVID that to the rest of the country looked late and cautious, and in Alberta looked like totalitarianism to the UCP base. And she has learned that lesson very clearly. She will not do things that risk provoking a backlash amongst the sort of more rural UCP base. And so I think she's just made a calculation that if she is going to lose, it will be in a general election. She will not be defeated from within. And so then it's on the NDP. It's on Nenshi. They have to be the ones to do the job. They can't wait for yet another internal rebellion to bring her down.
It seems like I agree. And I think, you know, as I mentioned before, Naheed Nenshi's was on the podcast, has certainly been available. If there's one thing to say about Danielle Smith is I don't think I've ever seen anyone be so more forthcoming and freely available for media. Because if you look at Polyev, you can't get an interview with Polyev unless you are from a fairly friendly sort of handpicked media person. With Danielle Smith, not the case at all. Danielle Smith will go on any show at any time and will do quite well handling, mm-hmm. navigating, redirecting questions. So what's happened with a media savvy person like Naheed Nenshi, who also at one point, having been on many, many programs with Nenshi, you could not see Nenshi. I mean, yes, he was the mayor of Calgary, but he was actually kind of the mayor of Canada in lots of ways. Like, he represented civic politics. He sort of coined the term purple movement and saying, you know, both conservative and liberal, he's neither. And now here he is heading up the Alberta NDP, and he's kind of disappeared in lots of ways. So what's happened there?
In a way, I think he's a victim of his own success. You know, when he became mayor, it was this very sort of out of left field situation. And then, you know, like you say, you know, New York Times started writing profiles. He very quickly became this sort of media darling, and he never really had to fight for relevance ever again. And certainly when he was mayor of Calgary, he always was able to command relevance, command respect. You know, if he talked, media listened. They were always interested in what he had to say. And in the framework of a municipal leader, his style of politics works really well because he's not, I don't think he's sort of naturally partisan the way Smith is or the way other people are. You know, he likes the debate. He likes to see both sides. He likes to sort of engage in sophistry. And I think that's what people really liked about him, is that he was a thoughtful guy, you know, the whole politics and full sentences thing. But we don't live in a world right now of politics and full sentences, and you can't will it Rachel. Into existence. And so he has kind of been silent because he's been unwilling to make his own political weather and unwilling to really kind of force the issue of his relevance. And he has to adapt, right? He has to adapt to this new environment of podcasts and online and the New York Times is not going to write another profile about him. They're just not. And he has to kind of get his elbows up in a way that he may not be comfortable doing. He's not an elbows up kind of guy, but that is what's required right now if you're going to get people's attention, especially in Alberta with everything that's going on. One of the advantages of being a government like the UCP, and this is you know, Bannon's flood the zone strategy, is when you're doing so many things or so many things are happening that are scandalous, it's hard for the opposition to get their voice in because the coverage is always, this is the thing that you're doing wrong. Oh, there's another thing. Oh, there's a scandal. Here's a lawsuit. You never get the spotlight as the opposition.
That's a smart strategy. And I think one thing that I've heard Nahinchi regularly say is, you know, let's think of the all perspectives on this issue. Let's look at the different ways that you can approach this. And in provincial politics, there just may not be space for that, particularly now. And it's pretty sad when reasonability is your fault.
You know, the Democrats in the United States proved that trying to tell truth to lies is no longer an effective strategy.
So
yeah, and there are some parallels there that he could certainly draw from. You don't get points for being calm and reasonable, unfortunately, in politics these days. And waiting around for people to kind of get with the program is not going to work.
Well, cannot say thanks enough, Miigwech Max, for coming. I also deeply appreciated your comment, which sort of we skated over, is that you can't just simply separate Alberta without Indigenous peoples, a conversation or new treaties. I just wanted to give you a heads up or just a great statement. I say that all the time. I'm glad other people are saying it too. Big Miigwech for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm happy to do it anytime. And yeah, happy to always remind my neighbors here in Alberta that, you know, we have relationships with people here who, you know, were here before us. And those relationships are more important than our sort of near-term political whimsies.
Thanks again to Max Fawcett.
Like, what a great interview that was. I actually, very efficient, but we, for over 45 minutes or so, got through a lot of stuff.
Yeah, those of you who may not have read Max Fawcett, what you heard there, the succinctness, I think is a word you used earlier, of his analysis is really kind of special. And it makes me want to go forth and be more succinct.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope that you get better, because I know you've been fighting this week, Dan, with a terrible sickness and you fought through that interview. I was almost going to just offer to give you a little Heimlich or something over there.
Yeah, well, hacking up a storm. The sound that you heard was not me retching about anything that anybody said. I was trying to suppress a cough.
Well, we're talking about Trump a lot, so I think you could be forgiven.
We're going to be trying to come to you on a regular basis during the federal election campaign.
I will be interested to see whether it will be issues or just Trump in times infinity in this election and how many times we'll see. But we certainly are seeing that it will be something that will grip the country. I think I would like to see election participation because I feel like this is going to be a highly participatory election.
I also think that it's probably time that we play an election drinking game.
Oh, they're another drinking
game. So every time Donald Trump mentions Canada in a pathetic attempt to influence the outcome of this election, you have to take a shot of Crown Royal.
Yeah. Famously made in Manitoba. Yeah.
And which means if you don't like Crown Royal, you better get to love it, because that Trump is going to, he's going to be baited by reporters in the
Dan, press even gallery, if just but... the three of us in this studio play that game, Gimli's not going to have enough stuff to produce.
Right. I do not endorse any of this, but we are looking for sponsors. So
please drink responsibly.
Give the quiet. What do they call that? An in conversation sponsorship.
A mid roll.
That's right.
Yeah, mid roll advertisement. Seagram's people. We anytime now you can just.
Big thanks to you, Dan, for making it in here and surviving through your sickness.
Thanks
to Adam always for putting up with us. And a huge thanks to everybody over at the Free Press, Paul Simon and Wendy Swatsky, who stages us nicely. And then, of course, all of our great friends and colleagues who continue to support the podcast. Check out our newsletters. We have both Dan and I have a free newsletter. With me, you get new Indigenous news from across the province and internationally, even in the United States. And from Dan, you get the most astute, political, sharpest ideas, thoughts, and ponderings, including a great piece that Dan wrote this week about the Bay.
The Bay, rest in peace, buddy.
Oh, no tears shed on this side of the table for the Hudson Bay Company.
You're still holding that grudge, eh?
I'll wrap myself in the blanket warmly as I'm watching entering into bankruptcy of the Hudson Bay Company.
Parenthetically, for people with no sense of humor, I think the grudge is warranted. But, anyways.
Thanks,
everybody. And we will see you soon during the election campaign.
You watch.